Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton on the line. I got Andrew Coburn. I love me some Coburns, man. I used to love Alex. He's gone now, but Patrick, of course, is the greatest war reporter in the world. And his brother Andrew does incredible work on the national security state here in the United States and how it works and operates at those levels. Welcome back to the show, Andrew. How are you, sir?
Hey, Scott. Good to be with you.
Very happy to have you back here on the show. Undelivered goods. How $1.8 billion in aid to Ukraine was funneled to the outposts of the international finance galaxy. What fun! tell us, first of all, you do a good job in the intro to the article here, giving us kind of the rundown, the catch-up. Pretend nobody in the audience ever heard of American intervention in Ukraine. So let us know, you know, I don't know. As you do here, kind of late 2013 through now, what's the crisis and the context, so then we can get to where all the money went?
Okay, fine. Ukraine, the country of Ukraine, is unfortunately kind of an economic basket case. Partly, on even maybe mostly, because all of the place is really controlled by these so-called oligarchs who basically control the economy of, you know, help themselves to big chunks of what was the Soviet economy there. So, that being the case, let me say, in 2013, it was decided that we should, that the IMF should give a huge amount of money to, Ukraine because, you know, to save it going under, to save the currency and all those good things. So, they announced that they were going to send $17 billion altogether, and they were sending $4 billion immediately. Now, the most important destination for this money was the country's banks, which were all going belly up, and most specifically, the largest bank, which is called Privatbank. And as it so happens, Privatbank is owned by a character called Igor Kolomoisky, or Ihor, if you go by the Ukrainian spelling. And Mr. Kolomoisky is quite well-liked in Washington, or was quite well-liked, because he, when the Eastern Ukrainians sort of decided they didn't care much for this sort of right-wing government or this very nationalist government that had appeared in Kiev, and they started to sort of agitate for separatism and separation and being backed by Putin's Russia and were advancing westward, Mr. Kolomoisky, who controlled a big, powerful economic region of Dnepropetrovsk, told all his workers to stop work and enlist in his private army, which he'd set up. And so the Kolomoisky private army kind of stopped the westward advance of the separatists. So got it so far. Kolomoisky, popular in Washington, owns the biggest bank in the country. Biggest bank is in big trouble, is going under, huge international loan money, $4 billion wired to the Ukrainian National Bank, and half of that goes to Mr. Kolomoisky's bank. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it was sorely needed. You know, the economy is going fat and all these people going without wages and so on and so forth. So what happened then? Well, the money, $1.8 billion of that, didn't go to really to prop up the Ukrainian economy. It went by a fairly magical process, or not very magical process, fairly straightforward process. It went offshore, first to Cyprus, and then off to the British Virgin Islands, and to Antigua, and to Belize, and all those sort of big financial hotspots, and disappeared. So we have a situation where our guy in Ukraine, or one of our guys in Ukraine, basically presides over an operation that swipes $1.8 billion. And that's, I think, the piece we're discussing today.
Yeah. So, well, we can get back to how we got into this mess and all that in a minute. But I like the way you described the scam. And, you know, it's very interesting to those of us who have never had those kinds of large amounts of money to move around in business or personally or any other way to just see how these kinds of things are done. So the U.S. government basically prints the money or conjures it up in a computer with their magic police power. And then they give it to the IMF, and then the IMF gives it to this guy's bank. And then how is it that he doesn't just put it straight in his pocket? He's got to bounce it off the roofs of a couple of places first, and then it goes back in his pocket. How's it
go? Okay. Well, here's a primer for anyone who wants to steal $1.8 billion from the IMF, owns a bank. And so basically what he did was the bank made big loans to a series of Ukrainian companies, which, as it so happened, seemed to be controlled indirectly by Mr. Kolomoisky, who owned the bank. And this money, these companies in turn, made big orders to overseas firms to import goods like, cranes, and there was a ice processing, a refrigeration plant, all sorts of stuff like that. And oddly enough, these companies seemed also to be controlled indirectly by entities which were in turn controlled by Mr. Kolomoisky. So, and the Ukrainian firms that had ordered these goods to the total value of $1.8 billion made advance payments for pending the arrival of these goods of 100%. So if they'd ordered a $100 million, refrigeration plant, they sent $100 million into the bank accounts of the companies they were buying the stuff from, which, as it so happened, these accounts were in the Cyprus branch of Privatbank, Mr. Kolomoisky's bank. So if you follow me so far, the bank that's owned by Kolomoisky gets the money from the IMF, from the central bank, which has got it from the IMF. They lend the money to the, to companies which are owned by Kolomoisky. The companies then send advance payments, orders goods, and send advance payments to other companies that are owned by Kolomoisky. And the money goes into the bank, the branch of the bank that's also owned by Kolomoisky. And then the money goes off into other entities, you know, as we said, in the far reaches of the financial galaxy, and mostly in the Caribbean, and hasn't been seen since. Mm. So, okay, now how do you make this legal? This is the important thing. Anyone who wants to try and do this should know this is an important twist. As time went by and no goods, of course, were arriving, the companies that had ordered the machinery and other stuff from abroad, they sued in the local court in the city that's controlled by Mr. Kolomoisky, where he was the governor, and said, we've ordered all these goods and they haven't arrived. We want our money back. And by the way, we also want to be let out of the loan, relieved from the obligation to pay back the loan we got from Privatbank. So, and in 42 out of 42 cases where these suits were brought, the court said, A, no, you're still on the hook for the loan, and B, no, you can't get the money. You're not getting the money back from abroad. So in other words, legally, the loan is still on the books. So private banks can say, well, you know, we're still owed these goods, and we're still owed this money, and it's all guaranteed by these goods that have been ordered from abroad, which have yet to turn up. Mm-hmm. In other words, there were legal fig leaf over the whole thing. This was first uncovered by a group of very plucky people, investigators in Ukraine.
Yeah, you said they just read it right in the court records. There was nothing secret about it. Whole scam's right there. I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you and stop you here and go out to this break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, and this book, this blog at Harper's, Undelivered Goods, about the theft of your tax money by Ukrainian oligarchs. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you all. Welcome back here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, Andrew Coburn, he wrote the book Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. You should read that thing, man. I'm telling you what, it'll blow your mind. There's so much stuff in there. Anyway. And that's just the stuff I can remember. There's even more stuff than that. And then his new book is Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And but here he is writing about the corruption in post-coup d'etat Ukraine. And this guy, Kolomaisky, there you go. Let him say it. So he got in good with the Americans because... After the coup, when the rebels in the East were really winning, he raised up a private army with his billions, that put a halt to their advance. And so that was what won him the friendship and loyalty of, Victoria Nuland and the crew, huh?
Correct. Victoria Nuland, for those, I should remind people, she's the Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern Europe. And she's really been running our Ukraine policy. And it's amazing. I mean, she's had an amazing career. She was an important person in the Clinton State Department, chief of staff to Strobe Talbot, who was Deputy Secretary of State. Then she was Dick Cheney's foreign policy advisor. Then she was ambassador to NATO. Then she was Hillary Clinton's spokesperson. Now she's got this, job running Eastern Europe. And she is married to Robert Kagan, who's like the sort of most fanatical of the neocon ideologues. In other words, this is a dyed-in-the-wool neocon who has been stoking up the tensions in Ukraine for, many years now. And, it's very dangerous. Ukraine goes in and out of the news. And yet, here we are confronting, what is still a major power. I guess as you can call Russia a superpower still. We've got lots of nuclear weapons. And no one seems to be paying much attention. And I tell this story of how basically one of our guys ripped off almost $2 billion and has now been given shelter in this country, by the way. He's living happily, I think, in Milwaukee at the moment. So it's a pretty shocking state of affairs.
Yeah, the whole thing is ridiculous. And by the way, if anybody wants to read about Victoria Nuland, there's a great old article from, 10 years ago or something by Jim Loeb called All in the Neocon Family. And it begins with a little bit of a profile of her, but it's really about how all of the worst neocons, you could basically fit at one Thanksgiving dinner. It's all the axis of Midge Dechter or whatever, the Podhoretzes and the Crystals and their relatives, down to Elliot Abrams and whatever, is very, very tightly knit group there. And in fact,
I was just going to say, it's amazing. Yeah, as you say, there's so few of them and how, they retain their grip on power. Newland's a good example, but maybe they had their nose a little bit put out of joint with this Iran business. But, basically, administrations come and go, but they're still there. It's just incredible.
They completely set the agenda for the entire argument about virtually every policy on TV and in the discussions, and it's just because they don't quit. Bill Kristol, he never stops smiling. He always seems like a nice guy, kind of, if you don't listen to what he's actually saying. And people just, I think in D.C., I don't live there. Maybe you could help me, but it seems like people figure, well, at least we know he'll have a very informed comment to say about whatever it is. So they just bring him on, and he just gets to set the agenda to such a degree. It's crazy.
It's outrageous. I just want to go back to this business about the money being stolen. It's fairly complicated, there's this legal mechanism and they swipe them, almost $2 billion. No one's making the slightest effort to, either indict anyone or to get the money back. And I want to contrast that with the IMF, I mean, the IMF certainly isn't. Meanwhile, the IMF is part of the gang that's screwing the poor old Greeks to the wall, and forcing them to sort of, you know, this mad sort of austerity program that they've got to endure for years and decades to come, because the Greeks were, committed the crime of electing a sort of left-wing populist government. Meanwhile, we've got this bunch of criminals in Ukraine who get, you know, pretty much our wholehearted support. It's completely, you know, just, I think it's important to look at this story to see how the world really works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and tell me this, do you know whether the Kiev government, the coup d'etat junta there, do they even mean to implement the Minsk II agreement? Because it seems like they've been, you know, still fighting in the east this whole time. And they're supposed to recognize this newly granted amount of autonomy for the east so that they wouldn't have anything to fight about anymore. And yet the fighting continues.
Well, you know, it's been noticed in the past that every time they run out of money because it's all been stolen, they announce that the Easterners have broken the ceasefire. And so everyone in the West sort of throws up their hands and rushes money and aid to Kiev. And, certainly there's plenty of people who'll tell you that they're the ones who break the ceasefire. So I don't know. It could be maybe sanity is breaking out in defiance of Nuland, and maybe Minsk II will be observed, and you know the Easterners will get their semi-autonomy. And but I don't think so. I think there's such a head of steam up behind the sort of get Russia clique that they're not going to stop now. I mean, you know, we have now. I could be wrong on the numbers. Something getting close to 1,000 NATO troops now in Ukraine training, you know, the Ukrainian forces. The pressure, as I mentioned in my article in Harper's, on the Harper's website, you know, all the time the rhetoric in Washington about we must send military aid to Ukraine. We really, Tom Daschle, important Democratic lobbyist, former majority leader, says we should send $3 billion in aid, partly military aid to Ukraine. So it's being jacked up all the time. I think it's really sinister. I think I'd like to think that everyone's going to observe the Minsk agreement and we can all be happy, but I'm not hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was just week before last they announced that they're not just training up the National Guard, which is a nice euphemism for a bunch of Nazis, but now they're going to go ahead and train up the entire army. And apparently they have thousands of Canadians and Australians and British and I guess, you know, that whole Anglophone alliance there. And, you know, I don't know if this is really relevant or not, but I was reading a couple of stories about Hillary Clinton's emails and about, well, there's this one in Politico about how there's this one lady who ever talks to her like a peer and tells her no, disagrees with her about anything, where everyone else is the lowest, most pathetic form of sycophant you could imagine, right? They make Smithers look like Burns. And so, I mean, what comes out of that is that no one ever tells her she's wrong about nothing, so therefore she doesn't know nothing. She starts out wrong about everything. No one ever informs her opinion whatsoever, so she's basically, you know, deaf, blind, and stupid up there, as bad as George W. Bush, it seems like. And I just wonder whether you think, like, that's really what's going on. Kind of, you said the head of steam behind this hate Russia thing. It's that stupid, isn't it? Well, geez, John McCain and Hillary Clinton agree that Vladimir Putin is a really bad guy, so let's just jump on this bandwagon. And there's no one really saying, come on, guys, we all know we're lying, right? Like, we did the coup, and they're just reacting. As long as we know we're lying, it's okay. But let's make sure we don't really believe our own stupid slogans here. But I'm not so sure that it's really like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly so. Exactly so. I mean, the most terrifying word in the Washington context is consensus. And once you've got the consensus on something, you know we're in for trouble. And now they're all agreeing, you know, they absolutely agree that, as you say, you know, Putin bad, gallant little Ukraine, you know, has to be saved. And, you know, I think that I've heard people, you know, important people in Washington say it's time we have to send, a lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine to kill more Russians. I mean, I swear to God, I've actually heard sort of high level State Department people say that.
Yeah. And in fact, that's kind of the talking point, like weapons of mass destruction, kill Russians. That's what they're saying. In fact, when they had the Brookings report that came out. And they had, oh man, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the ambassador who had, it was Michelle Flournoy and a few others, had done this report, I guess about a year ago now, saying that we needed to send all these weapons. And I remember the guy was interviewed on, National Public Radio, the head ambassador. Man, if chat room guys, if you know the name of the guy I'm thinking of,
Herbst.
Help me out here.
Herbst. But, what do you call it, Herbst or something, the former ambassador to Ukraine?
No. Yeah. Anyway, but and his argument was that if we kill Russians, if the war in Ukraine gets worse, and we're killing more Russians and sending more Russians home in body bags, then that will upset the mothers of the dead soldiers, and that will cause the debate to go up in Russia.
Yes.
That was how he said it. The debate to go up. That we're going to make the debate go up. Well. So by killing Russians and sending Russians home in body bags, their so-called calculus is that it will become politically impossible for Putin and everybody to his right to wage a war to avenge those deaths. Oh, hell no. That's not even, you know, possible in this universe. It will, after the debate goes up, they'll decide to just let America screw them in Ukraine as bad as we want, and they'll no longer do anything about it. What a brilliant policy.
Yeah. By the way, I think it is. I think we are talking about John Herbst. He's a complete maniac.
It could
be. He was ambassador to Ukraine.
I was thinking it was a longer, like three syllable name with an A at the beginning somewhere, but I'd have to look at it.
Could be.
But anyway, I mean, all these. I mean, but that's kind of the level of argument here. We're gonna send dead Russians home when they're kind of pretending that there's been this, you know, giant invasion by the Russian infantry anyway. But assuming that there are some special forces there, which I guess is a safe assumption that. I mean, is that really what passes for an argument? Is that by killing them, that's going to make them want to bow down to us rather than make them angry enough to want to fight even more? I mean, this is a country that lost 20 million people killing the Germans in World War II. They're just going to bow down and take this from the U.S. right now?
Exactly so. I mean, you know, it's completely insane. And it's, you know, it's like... you know, it's like all the other arguments, you know, that, like sanctions. I mean, it's a whole other story why we've had these negotiations with the Iranians. But in my belief, it's not because of sanctions. You know, there's always this belief if you inflict pain on people, they'll do what you tell them. But actually, history shows that's not what happens.
Yeah.
And it's certainly true what you're saying here. I mean, that it's obscene anyway. And what they're really talking about is killing more Ukrainians, by the way. We're going to kill another 50,000 Ukrainians, you know, the people we supposedly love in pursuit of this, you know, lunatic policy. And in the meantime, you know, we smile as, you know, as these criminals. I mean, it was just one little story. There's so much more you could say about, you know, the looting of Ukraine. But I just told this story on the Harper's blog just to show this is what's really going on. You know, we smile as these people get completely ripped off. And meanwhile, we're planning to kill another tens of thousands of them and all in the name of love.
Yep. Well, it's good journalism. I'm sure glad you're doing it. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Hey, thank you, Scott. Always a pleasure.
All right, y'all, that is Andrew Coburn. He's the author of Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. Got that right. Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, which is great. You really got to read that. And check him out over at Harper's. Heart of Empire is his blog there. Undelivered Goods, How $1.8 billion in aid to Ukraine was funneled to the outposts of the international finance galaxy. Hey, y'all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.